Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour, PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Larry Pinkney. It's great having Larry back. Oh, I missed you, Larry. I missed you. I missed being on air, not being on air. I missed being able to be on this program with wonderful guests like you talking about the major issues of the day at home and abroad. So it's terrific having you back on, Larry. Welcome.
Thank you, thank you. I missed you beyond words, Stephen. But you know what? You were always there in spirit. I was getting very worried, but it is great being back with you.
Well, I must say, aside from struggling with trying to get well again, the thing I miss most was not being able to write daily articles, and my usual volume is a couple a day. When I'm in top form once in a while, I would do three a day. That's a little bit of a stretch, but I've done it a number of times. And to be able to go on air hosting my program and to be able to accommodate others who ask me all the time to give interviews. And I must say, I was thrilled, Larry. I came home on the 6th of August after beginning my ordeal on the 4th of June, and on the very day I came home, Press TV called me. I put out I knew what I was going to write. I knew what my first article would be. I called it Back from the Abyss. I wanted to explain to my readers and friends and colleagues what I simply couldn't tell anybody, why I was ill. I was offline. I didn't have access to a computer. I didn't have any of my email addresses. And I felt obligated to tell people what was going on. And this was my first time to do it. I combined that in an article with discussing a little bit about the major issues I wish I could have been writing about, but wasn't able to, and I put that all in one article. It wasn't a super long article. It might have been about 1,200 words or so, maybe a little less than my typical article, but I got that out, and the responses to it started pouring in immediately. People welcoming me back, wishing me well, and there was a comment I was going to make. I forget it now. Press TV. Press TV called me, invited me on to discuss Gaza the afternoon of August 6th. I mean, I just came home. I was settling into my apartment, putting stuff away, getting a little bit of help. But I was just thrilled to death that they called me, and they had me on for a short interview. And I just thought that was absolutely wonderful. Then they had me on successive days after that. That was a Wednesday. I remember they had me on Thursday for something else. They had me, no, for Gaza, but on a different program. And then Saturday and Sunday, they had me back on again for Gaza, and they've had me on several times since then, which was just wonderful. I've had a few other interviews as well, but the volumes of get well, welcome back stuff that came at me, just a tsunami of it, Larry, from so many people in so many places, it just energized me. It gave me the energy and the extra spirit to know that the people really, really followed what I did and missed the fact that my voice wasn't out there, but it horrified me that I couldn't be writing about the horrors going on in Gaza, the horrors going on in Ukraine, all the other things that are going on that I focus on so often. But now I'm back, Larry. I'm not 100%, but I think I'm heading in that direction. And lately, I've been back to my two article a day regimen, and I'm thrilled to death to be able to do it, Larry.
Well, you know, Stephen, you have seen firsthand now how incredibly important and significant your voice is and your analysis is. I can tell you, for example, that my editor over at IntrepidReport.com, we were discussing you and all both of us greatly concerned, greatly worried, one, about you as a human being and your well-being, and two, about the fact that we really, really miss and need your voice. So all I can say, you know, jumping back to that old TV program, Welcome Back, Cotter, is welcome back, Stephen. We love you.
Oh, Larry, you're awfully kind. I just feel like I'm an average guy in the trenches who honestly wants to do the right thing and tell people what I think they need to know instead of the garbage they get on propaganda TV and in print publication. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about Fox News or the New York Times. You get the same kind of rubbish over and over again. New York Times is a little bit more polished than Fox News, but it's the same rubbish repeated over and over again, and the cable channel have the advantage, because that's where most most people go for what they think is news, information, and analysis. You'd think by now they knew better. And the only good news is the TV ratings are going down, the cable channels are losing audiences, and the alternative media is gaining in prominence. I haven't checked lately on PRN, but I remember some months back, it seems to me I got information that PRN on a regular basis was gaining many, many new followers, people tuning into the various PRN programs because they wanted to get real information. And you sure don't get it on CNN or MSNBC or CBS or NBC or the others, including in the New York Times. I don't think anybody's a more severe critic of the New York Times than I am. And the article I wrote a couple of years ago, Larry, that I know got the greatest number of readers of anything I ever wrote by far was an open letter I wrote to New York Times editors on one modestly followed website. It got close to 50,000 readers. And I don't know how many web editors posted it, but I know by far that was my most well-read article. Because it touched a nerve. It touched a nerve about the unreliability, I could put it that way, of the major media, that if you really want to know what's going on in the country and around the world, you're sure not going to get it from the major media. And it's why I call them media scoundrels. They sure are scoundrels.
They are. They are indeed. You know, as you were speaking, as you were talking just now, my brother, I was thinking about the article was published that I wrote a few days ago in the first part of this month in Intrepid Report. And the article, ironically, the name of the article is Rejecting the Vomit of the Government and Corporate Stream Media. And, my God, that's essentially what it is. It's regurgitated lies, just regurgitated, repackaged lies, whether we're talking about Syria, Iraq, Iran, Palestine, or whether we're talking about right here in the United States. All we get from this corporate stream media is vomit. It's regurgitated, repackaged lies. So, oh, I'm so glad you're back, my brother.
Well, Larry, I love that word vomit. I mean, that's exactly what it is. I mean, it really is vomit. In an article I put out, I believe it was yesterday afternoon, on the there was an incident in southeastern Ukraine, I believe in the Donetsk area, being heavily bombed and shelled. Two areas are being heavily bombed and shelled in the southeastern Ukraine. More than two, but the two that are the largest and most significant with the largest populations, Donetsk, with close to 1 million people, and Lugansk. I forget the population of Lugansk, but also in the hundreds of thousands, at least a few hundred thousand, I believe. And just horrific terror bombing and shelling is going on. And there was an incident. Many of the residents of these areas have tried to flee. There was a convoy fleeing, I believe, the Donetsk area, and it was shelled. And many people were killed. Some were incinerated in their cars on a major highway leading out of the city, leading out of the area. And the New York Times wrote an article, quoting the Ukrainian military that has no legitimacy whatsoever. Ukraine is run by neo-Nazi-infested fascists, illegitimate ones, because a coup d'etat staged by Washington put them in power. And it quoted the Ukrainian military, blaming the freedom-fighting Democrats, as I like to put them. Well, I don't have any evidence one way or the other who did this, but it's possible the incident never happened in the first place. But the New York Times headline wasn't an impartial, unbiased headline discussing the incident. It was saying the rebels bomb refugee convoy, something like that, Ukraine military says. And my first comment was, what are the freedom fighting Democrats say? What do they have to say? It was a disgusting headline.
They don't care. They don't care, Stephen. You know, the more I have looked at the corporate stream vomit from whether it's New York Times, Fox News, NBC, CBS, ABC, PBS, all of them, the more I look at it, the more disgusting and sickening it really is, you know, with respect to everything, not just Ukraine, but especially as I have looked as it relates to what is happening there. And I'm so glad you brought up the fact that this has all, you know, gotten its beginning from Washington. Mr. Hope and Change, Mr. Rope and Chain, Mr. Drone Man, Mr. Double Talking, Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Susan Rice, and an endless list that won't be missed, as I say. So, and this is both Democrats and Republicans committing genocide. Let's be blunt. This is genocide. And then trying to blame Russia, trying to blame anyone but or anything and anyone but their own despicable, hypocritical, lying policies. And, you know, it's just intolerable. It's just intolerable. Whether we're talking, as I said before, about Ukraine, about Russia, about Syria, about Iraq, about Iran, the whole point is that all we get are lies. And there is no such thing as honest reporting and across-the-board reporting from outlets such as the New York Times. I have another name for the New York Times, and I call it the New York Untimes. Because we are lied to so much, and their bias is so strong that it's frankly almost beyond belief. But we've got people like you, people like me, we've got folks out there. That's why the corporate stream media's ratings are going down, and they will continue to plummet, because we are doing our job, and we need more people to do their job, my brother. So. There's always that lining, that silver lining of what I call actualized hope. Again, I'm just so thrilled to be hearing your voice, speaking with you. You're right on it. You're sharp as a tack. Right on, my brother.
Well, Larry, I'm delighted to be back, and I must say I went through moments when I wasn't sure if I'd ever be back, but I sure am now, and hopefully I'll be 100% at some point or close enough to it. I wanted to get in one comment about the New York Times. My favorite line, I've used it a number of times, characterizing the New York Times, is to say, all the news it claims fit to print isn't fit to read. And I think that sums up the New York Times. Oh, there are kernels of truth that the New York Times publishes. The most important kernels of truth that they publish are usually buried well into an article that most people who even look at the column will never get to really know what the heck was going on. And there are so many examples of how the New York Times betrayed its readers. So many examples. Oh, one just popped into my head. When Judith Miller, the disgraced correspondent who was little more than a reporter writing or regurgitating Pentagon press releases in the media. Probably nobody was more responsible for getting for arousing fear of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that did not exist, and getting and creating a justification for an unjust war of aggression against a country that absolutely did not threaten America in any way, and millions of Iraqis have died since 2003 alone, plus all of the ones who died from the Gulf War beginning in January 1991 with the sanctions years under Bill Clinton. I don't know how many Iraqis have died, but it's well into the multi-millions, and nobody talks about this. So we're talking about human beings, and then this stuff goes on at home. I know you want to talk about Ferguson. We certainly want to get into that, Larry. I mean, we talk about the horrors abroad. I mean, people abused by the millions, murdered or abused by the millions. But look at the stuff that goes on at home. And Ferguson is just one example of what happens no matter where you live. And I quoted I wrote about police brutality in America a couple of days ago, and I quoted the ACLU calling Ferguson every town USA. And it is every town USA.
Good point. You know, Stephen, when I think of Ferguson, let me say this very quickly. You know, here we have this drone man, Barack Obama, talking about he is going to gain justice for the journalist that was beheaded, okay, by the very group, by the way, beheaded by the very group that the United States is supporting. Obama and his minions support this same group of people or individuals. I don't know if I can call them people, but the same group in Syria. Come on, talk about hypocrisy. And when we speak of Ferguson, I think not only of the tragedy as it relates to people in the streets trying to exercise their constitutional rights, which are being repressed and have been repressed on a daily basis, and supported by the corporate stream media, this repression, but also here we have on one hand what the tragic tragic events that have taken place with respect to an American journalist in Iraq. And what's happening to the journalists, particularly with respect to the quote-unquote alternative media? What is America doing? What is Obama doing to the journalists in Ferguson? Why are they arrested, brutalized, beaten, shot at with bullets, sprayed with tear gas? I mean, come on. The hypocrisy of it is absolutely glaring. It's the elephant, if you will, in the living room. And that's, again, where people come, like people like you and I are very important. All of us, our brothers and sisters who are getting this information out there.
Larry, I think in Ferguson, at least half a dozen journalists have been abused this way for exercising their First Amendment rights, freedom of the press. They get abused. I mean, they're arrested. I mean, they can throw them in jail for doing their job. It really is disgusting.
Yes. And what I'm hoping and what I'm attempting to play my part in is, you know, putting these contradictions, putting this hypocrisy in front of the faces of everyday, ordinary black, white, brown, red, and yellow people, particularly people in this nation, because, you know, people, sheeple, whatever you want to call them, but we don't have to be sheeple. We have to be critically thinking, conscious, informed, operative word, informed people. So our job is to continue putting this out there, and I think we're doing it. We need to do it more, and we need to do it persistently and consistently. But I think that more and more people in this nation are awakening. I think that outside of the United States, there are a tremendous amount of people that have already been awakened and are very much aware of what the horrible things, the horrible contradictions, the horrible hypocrisies of Washington, of the Obama regime. And I say Obama regime, but it's both Democrats and Republicans. It's not just the Democrats. It's both of them. They drink from the same treacherous, bloody trough.
Oh, so true, Larry. I'm convinced that whoever replaces Obama in January 2017 will exceed the worst of his administration, the worst of his crimes. The beat goes on from one administration to another. It simply doesn't matter. And it seems as though whoever replaces the previous administration manages to perform in a worse way. And you're right. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about Democrats or Republicans. Anybody who thinks Bill Clinton was so good compared to George Bush or Obama or Ronald Reagan, well, Clinton had a worse record than Ronald Reagan did, and of course Bush had a worse record than Clinton. I could remind listeners of the Clinton record that I wrote so much about in the aftermath of his administration, because I didn't start writing until after he was out of office. But there were so many horrors. There may be 1.5 million Iraqis who died during his administration because of the sanctions, and intermittent bombing alone was maybe his most horrific war crime and crime against humanity. But there were so many other examples of the horrors he committed at home and abroad. He waged war on poor people in America, Larry, where he ended, mm-hmm. he ended welfare as we know it. It's a long name of the law that he sanctioned. I can't think of the law, but it's just too long. But basically, he ended welfare for people who desperately need help, and they just cut it back so badly, so the working mothers cannot stay home and take care of their kids. Horrible stuff like this. I mean, Nixon had a better social justice record than Bill Clinton. Nixon did some good things social justice wise, but Clinton just decimated so many social justice things. Plus all of the crimes against humanity he committed, and then of course when George Bush came along with 9/11 and the rest of it, I mean, America has just been war on a scale never before had it undertaken one to that extent. It was more slow motion before. I mean, wiping out the native population was maybe its most horrific back, going back far enough, but it happened over a few centuries. But in 15, 14 years or so post 9/11, the millions of people that America has murdered in cold blood, it is shocking and disgusting, and it goes on every day. America is responsible for who knows how many deaths, how much destruction, and the wars go on. I wonder if the Afghan war alone, Larry, will ever end. America wants to keep so many troops there, 10,000, 20,000, whatever. I wonder if 10 years from now, you and I are on this program together, we'll be talking about, when on earth are we going to end this Afghanistan war? It's been going on for over 20 years.
Right, already the longest war that this country has blatantly engaged in. And I say that in quotation marks because we have to remember that the United States is always at war. It is always attacking, even though it depicts itself as this innocent little lamb, when in reality what it is doing both internally to its own people as well as externally to people throughout Mother Earth is just horrible. And, you know, I'm hopeful that we will get a critical mass. And when I say we, I mean everyday ordinary struggling people will stop drinking the Kool-Aid of the Democrat and Republican Party. Stop drinking the Kool-Aid. That we will get a poisonous Kool-Aid, by the way, and we will get a critical mass of people who recognize that neither of them, I call it the Democrat, Republican, Republicrat plantation. We need to get off the plantation, stop supporting our own destruction, stop supporting the destruction, if you will, of Mother Earth, our precious, precious Mother Earth. Stop supporting it. Stop supporting the slaughter of people, no matter what pretext it is done under. It's just like in this country. There's always a pretext for why some atrocity was committed and is still being, or I should say, are still being committed, these atrocities. So I'm hopeful that we will finally, as a people in this nation, break this sick, and I mean S-I-C-K, cyclical, as in circle, round and round, that we will break this cyclical madness that we have allowed ourselves to be stupored in, because we have been in a stupor, a drunken stupor, and that we will break it, and we will say no more. We don't accept this nonsense. They're lies. They're not only lies, but as a result of them, people are dying and being murdered, massacred, et cetera, all over the planet of Mother Earth. So I have hope that more people, we need a critical mass. You know, it's like what Margaret Mead said about never doubting that a small group of powerful people can make a difference, because in fact it's the only thing that ever has. And I'm hoping that we will get that critical mass.
Oh, absolutely. I love that quote from Margaret Mead. I've used it a few times myself. I wish she was around today, Larry. I certainly would invite her on this program. She'd be a marvelous guest. I can think of other people no longer with us who would also be marvelous guests. Oh, my goodness. Well, I began my real career at age 70, writing and media work. It seems like my entire life up to that point was meaningless, and everything began at age 70. It shows it's never too late, and I hope I've got a good number of years left. I wanted to mention one thing. In my article I wrote about police brutality in America, in 1994, Congress passed what it called the Police Accountability Act. It was incorporated into a Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act the same year. And candidate Obama in 2007 or 2008 promised that he would back and support and be sure was put in place a blueprint for change to ban and criminalize racial profiling and related mistreatment, especially the kind of stuff that goes on when cops do the brutalization. And President Obama, as we can imagine, Larry, did absolutely nothing. And a line I like to use about him is, another promise made, another broken, and the constituencies that supported him overwhelmingly, the ones that supported him most, are the ones who suffer most.
That is so true. I got to repeat that. His constituency, that is to say that the ones who support, I love that, because it's so accurate. The ones who support Obama, the Obamatron drone man, the most are the ones who suffer the most. And this is, I like that. Please keep saying that, because it's so accurate. People need to wake up and understand that. The reality is that we have a militarized, and I repeat, militarized police forces throughout this country. It is absolutely unacceptable that the police be using heavy equipment, i.e. ATCs, this is armored personnel carriers and the like, high-tech weaponry, tear gas, the list goes on and on and on. It is utterly unacceptable you know, this is something that one would expect to find in an openly fascist country. I believe, quite frankly, that the United States has already entered a period. That is to say, the corporate-owned U.S. government has already entered a period of what I call 21st century fascism, and they're taking off the gloves. It's time for everyday, ordinary, black, white, brown, red, and yellow people to take off our glove in the sense of saying, we are not going to tolerate this. You have taken our ideals, you have taken our country, and you keep giving us this regurgitated nonsense, this vomit. I remember well the poem, as I'm sure you do, Stephen, of Langston Hughes, the poem, Let America Be America Again. Let America, every time I read that poem, chills run through my body, because I think it's perhaps more apropos, more appropriate today in the 21st century than way back when Langston wrote that poem. And then the other poem that Langston Hughes also wrote, is What Happens to a Dream Deferred? The last sentence of the poem being a question, and the question is, or does it explode? Well, if it's going to explode, let it explode with consciousness. Let it explode with principled unity for all of us. For all of us, for the sake of this nation, but also for the sake of the people of Mother Earth, throughout Mother Earth. So I just, you reminded me of those two things when you were talking, Steve.
There really can be change in the country, Larry, and it certainly has happened in the history of America. It can happen anywhere, and it does happen in lots of places. You get revolutions that can either be violent or nonviolent, but in America, the civil rights struggles paid off. Unfortunately, there's no Martin Luther King around today, and the energy wanes, and all the gains just fade away. And it's been a while, but I remember quoting a civil rights leader a few years ago, can't remember the person's name, saying that things today are worse than they were in the 1960s or 50s,
yes.
before the civil rights legislation was passed, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. Things are worse today than they were then. And the same thing is with America's war agenda, the anti-war sentiment that was sustained, committed by many, many people around the country on college campuses and other places. And it went on year after year after year, and that combined with a lot of other elements went into ending the Vietnam War, and now the war's in only when the powers that be decide they want to end, or maybe change them in some form, just wind down the heavy war and go to an occupation, and then go back and wage another one whenever you want. I mean, we had the Gulf War against Iraq in 1991, we had Bush's 2003 war, and now we've got Obama's war against Iraq. And what is that going to lead to? More U.S. troops on the ground? Another quagmire? What's going to happen? Anytime America decides it wants to go to war with a country, it feels that it's justified to doing it. Well, I mean, certainly international law, which is also constitutional law, has it exactly the opposite. It is illegal to interfere in the internal affairs of another country. It is illegal to attack another country except in self-defense, and only the Security Council can authorize it. No authorization from the Security Council, no legal war. There certainly has been no security authorization for all the post 9/11 wars, none whatsoever, and yet America wages them, certainly did. Afghanistan, Iraq twice now, Libya, Obama's proxy war against Syria, and proxy wars against other countries, Yemen, Somalia, and U.S. Special Forces operate. These are killers. These are trained killers. They operate either overtly or covertly in at least two-thirds of the world's countries, and the CIA, they're everywhere. They're in every country on earth, every single one of them, and they don't go as goodwill ambassadors.
By no means, by no means. And we have to understand that I'm trying to remember the indigenous leader. I don't remember if it was Chief Seattle or if it was another, if it was Geronimo. But anyway, the point being, doesn't really matter who said it, but this indigenous leader said, we must remember that what you do to us, meaning what this government did and has still done to the indigenous native peoples, is exactly what's going to occur to everyday people right here who are in this country. And we have to remember that. We used to use the expression, which I'm sure you're familiar with, what goes around comes around. That's why I keep saying we have to break this insane cycle. You know, people shrug their shoulders who know anything about the NDAA, the horrible provisions of indefinite detention, and indefinite imprisonment. Okay, the rendition where people are tortured, and I mean brutally tortured and murdered as proxies of the U.S. I mean, the list just goes on and on. I keep saying that, but we have to understand that this emanates from here. We have to deal with these things right here. You know, the Obamatron, Drone Man, Barack Obama is actually G.W. Bush on steroids. We don't want someone else who's going to be even worse, as you pointed out. We have got to break this cycle. We have a responsibility. We must do that. Our very survival is at stake. And people need to stop referring to the United States as a democracy. The United States is not a democracy. It had ideal of being a democracy as a republic. But the corporations, whether we're talking about media, whether we're talking about any other sector of the economy, the corporations have been allowed by we the people to just literally take over. I remind people to remember the definition of what fascism is, the definition from Benito Mussolini, who should know, having been a fascist dictator. I remind people to remember that definition, where you have the state and corporations who really run and control every aspect of your country. That's fascism, and that's what we have. We have 21st century fascism, but we got to do something about it. It's not enough to sit back and whine, not that we're whining, but it's not enough to say this is what we have. We need a blueprint, many blueprints, not any single blueprint, but we need a blueprint to put together collectively to get the heck out of this insanity, to break this fascist grip currently being led by people like Obama, Eric Holder, Joe Biden, Susan Rice, etc.
Oh, for absolute certain, Larry. I mean, America has never been beautiful as far as I'm concerned. At the same time, I'm old enough to remember an earlier time when things were a lot better than now. They sure weren't perfect. I mean, I also remember the horrific racism that went on when I was growing up and the homophobia and the rest of it. And yet things are so much worse now, where America literally is waging a nonstop war against humanity. And the millions, I like to put it, the millions of corpses attest to America's brutality. America really is a fascist state. It conforms to the definition that you mentioned, and a whole lot of others that you can add with it. Control of the media, the horrific crimes of war and against humanity it commits against people both at home and abroad, and spurning of democracy in every way that you and I believe that democracy should be practiced. It certainly is not that way in America. America is a democracy in name only, and this is the country that we live in, Larry. I mean, it makes us feel ashamed to live in a country that claims a certain set of credentials, but by its practices is really something entirely different, polar opposite the principles it claims to endorse, and the harm that it causes to so many people at home and abroad, just unmatched, unprecedented in human history. And it's been this way throughout the entire history of the country, except it's much worse now because the weapons available are so much stronger, can do so much more destructive than the weapons of earlier times. I guess we've gone from bows and arrows, Larry, to nuclear bombs, and heroic people like Bertrand Russell have made comments like, we have a choice. We can either have world peace or we can destroy humanity. And really, that's what it's come down to. And there were crazies in the country who literally may end up destroying humanity. The human species may end up the same, maybe the only species that ever ends up destroying itself. And the risk is very real. And the idea of challenging Russia with the possibility that America could get into war with a nuclear power that can match America blow for blow. What kind of leaders think this way? Who would ever take a risk like that? And on the other hand, Russia continually, I've written so much about this, Russia goes all out to foster peaceful conflict resolution, and yet it's blamed for what it doesn't do. Vladimir Putin, the president, Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister. I don't know of any foreign minister more heroic than Sergei Lavrov. I've quoted him so many times. I've watched the things that he's been doing. I've written about them so many times. In the face of such unjustifiable criticism, he keeps going all out to resolve big conflicts like Ukraine equitably, peacefully, stop the killing, stop the conflict. I mean, if anybody deserves a Nobel Prize, it's Sergei Lavrov. But I think Vladimir Putin does too, because Lavrov takes his orders from the president. And if Putin did not want peace instead of conflict, then Lavrov's agenda would be entirely different. And you look at America, America says one thing, Larry, as we know, and does something entirely different, one war after another nonstop.
Yes, I mean, depending on how the weather is, who knows what U.S. politicians will say. But whatever they say, that's why I refer to Drone Man Obama as a double-talking hypocrite. He's a double-talking hypocrite, but he's not the only one. That has become synonymous with what U.S. politicians are. They seem incapable of telling the truth. Incapable. It's not like they don't know. They do know, but they are incapable and unwilling to tell the truth, to stand up and say, no, I'm not going along with this policy. No, I cannot accept this. And this is something that we the people, it always comes back, I believe, to we the people, everyday, ordinary, black, white, brown, red, and yellow people. We have got to put the brakes on. We have got to put the brakes on this insanity. You're absolutely right, Stephen, when you refer to the very idea of thinking about a nuclear or thermonuclear confrontation with a nuclear power such as Russia, or China for that matter, but in this case such as Russia, is the height of insanity. One cannot be even any more insane. It makes One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest look mild by comparison. And these are our so-called leaders. They're not leaders. They're bloodsuckers. They're avaricious, greedy, lying, despicable war criminals. Let's say it like they are. They have declared war on the people of this nation. They have declared war, in your words, and you are absolutely correct, they have declared war and carried out war against all of humanity. We the people, everyday, ordinary, struggling people of all colors, it's time for us to say no more. Put our little petty differences aside, come together and say no more. We're going to creatively bring about something different. Let's remember the words of Margaret Mead, those words that I quoted earlier. I, too, as you can tell, really, really love them.
Well, Larry, there is no question. I think listeners to this program understand it well. Maybe they'll tell others who don't understand. But there is only one change. There's only one way change ever happens, when ordinary people at the grassroots decide they will be committed with sustained efforts over a long enough period of time to struggle for, to fight for what they want. I believe in doing it nonviolently. And if they do it long enough, then maybe the change can come. There's a wonderful quote from the former muckraking journalist I.F. Stone, who passed away about 25 years ago. It's a very long quote, and I can't quote it verbatim, but he said something to the effect that the only way change ever comes is when ordinary people are committed this way, and they struggle for change, and they pass the baton on to somebody else, and these people never gain the change that they're struggling for, but they pass the baton on to somebody else, and they never win their struggles, but they pass the baton on to somebody else, and finally the struggles that began many years earlier are won because the building blocks were put in place, and at some point the baton receiver is able to accomplish what the people at the earliest stage of the game couldn't do because of the work of those people early on. They made it possible. These are the way great struggles are won. It's never won at the ballot box. It's never won from the top down. If you think throwing out the bums will change anything, well, we should realize that all we're going to get are new bums. They have different names, but they're all bums. The entire Congress, the administrations, Republican or Democrat, they're simply two branches of the same form of government. You could put Mickey Mouse in the Oval Office and nothing would change. You could put an electronic image in the Oval Office and nothing will change. And the only way to change it, I think the system, Larry, is so corrupted and so broken, so hopelessly beyond fixing, that the only way for real democratic change is to rip it down to the ground and start over again and just hope, fingers crossed, that maybe a second try at building a nation that's worth being called a democracy might turn out better than it did the first time. But even the founding fathers, who certainly were at least the well-known ones, the Jeffersons of the world and the Madison and the Washington. I mean, I'd take them ahead of the Bushes and the Obamas in a heartbeat, but I've said on this program and I've written that America's first Supreme Court Justice, John Jay, who really was not one of the founding fathers, but first Supreme Court Justice, said America should be run by the people who own it, and that's exactly the way the country was structured. You could say Jefferson and Adams weren't founding fathers either, because Adams was ambassador to Britain when the Philadelphia Convention took place, and Jefferson was the ambassador to France at the time. I think they were a little bit, not Adams, I think Jefferson was a little bit more democratic, maybe Lincoln a little bit more democratic, but not the way you and I would want them to be, Larry. They basically supported the system. And, of course, Jefferson had slaves. Washington had slaves. So we can see they weren't exactly lily pure by any means. And at the same time, they were certainly a far cry from the kind of people running the country today. It just seems to have gone downhill more and more over the years and decades and generations. I don't think we can survive, Larry, unless we can find a way to change the way America is run today.
I think you're absolutely right. And for example, what you mentioned about, you know, Jefferson and Adams and others, you know, yes, I'll be the first to say that, for example, Jefferson definitely had some very, very serious faults. On the other hand, I don't think that there's any comparison between the Thomas Jefferson of those centuries ago to the G.W. Bushes or the Barack Obamas. These people are total, utter monsters. And I'm just going to say it like it is. And we have allowed this. What we need is systemic change. We need systemic change. You know, I do agree with Jefferson when he said that every generation needs a new revolution. I think he understood. I think he foresaw what could happen. And this has unfortunately been allowed to happen by we the people. Yes, there's repression. Yes, we're all spied on. Our telephone calls, our computers, everything we do. There's no such thing as privacy in this country. What a joke. What a sham. Okay? But at the same time, that's par for the course. We know that. We know that. We know that they're all about subterfuge. We know that. That should not stop us from doing what we have to do. In fact, if anything, it should be even more of an incentive to bring about systemic, and that's the word I like to use because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about systemic change, real change, root change. The word radical comes from the Latin derivative root, R-O-O-T. We need systemic change. That's the only kind of change that will save us and perhaps all of humanity. But when I say us, I'm talking about saving this nation, making it, I like the way you put it, I can't remember word for word how you said it, Stephen, but making this nation worthy of being a nation part of the human family, worthy of actually being able to call itself in any real substantive sense democratic.
Oh, true, Larry. The thing I fear most is the possibility of another world war because of the mentality and the agenda of people running America, Republicans and Democrats. I think the threat is very real, and if anybody scoffs at a notion like that, you have to remember that we had two world wars, and maybe people felt they were impossible, and the First World War was called the war to end all wars. Well, it didn't end them. It just kind of suspended them for a couple of decades, and then we had World War II. Is it out of the question we couldn't have a third world war? The scary part is that the weapons we have today make the earlier ones look like toys. There were no nuclear bombs until the end of World War II, so you could get a lot of people killed, but it was slow motion. I mean, we could wipe out planet Earth in a day or two. There was a movie I saw, I mentioned it in a recent article that I wrote, On the Beach in the 1950s. on the beach. It was about the end of the world at the end of war after World War III, taking place supposedly in the 1960s, and and Fred Astaire played a part of an Australian scientist. Fred Astaire, you usually think of song and dance. Well, there was no singing and there was no dancing, and at the end of the film, Fred Astaire committed suicide. Because he thought that was preferable, carbon monoxide suicide, because he felt that was that was preferable to dying from painful nuclear radiation. But on the beach with Gregory Peck and Ava Gardner and Fred Astaire, a story about the end of the world. And the end of the film was chilling. I'll mention it because it was so chilling. Near the end of the film, it showed Melbourne, Australia, bustling with life. And in the very end of the film, it showed Melbourne, Australia, devoid of people, nobody on the streets, with just the wind blowing papers and things around the street. Human life was extinguished, and Australia, because of it being down under, was the last place where people died. People died everywhere else, certainly in America. They were all gone. In Europe, they were all gone. Latin America, they were all gone. And Australia was the end, and Melbourne showed empty streets. Finally, the people in Australia gone because of a nuclear war, obviously, between America and Russia. Is it impossible? Look at all the Russia bashing going on today. Totally unjustified. Absolutely unjustified. And the name of the game is regime change in Russia. An independent country, America wants a stooge government in, running the country, a government it controls. That's the name of the game, and Ukraine is a pretext for all of that. Is it impossible we couldn't get into a confrontation with Russia? Is it impossible we couldn't start lobbing nuclear bombs at each other? Is it impossible we couldn't destroy humanity? Well, I don't think it's impossible at all. I'm old enough, so I've had a lot of years behind me. The younger people in the country should worry a lot by that. And it's up to us, Larry. It's up to ordinary people to protect ourselves. If we don't do something to stop this juggernaut that's heading us for potential Armageddon, then we may get what we surely hope will not happen, but it absolutely could.
Yes, yes. In fact, I would say, Stephen, I would say that it's not only possible. When I say it, now I'm referring to a world holocaust. The destruction of humanity is not only possible, but it's quite probable if we do not take very, very, very strong action throughout this nation. It's probable, beyond possible. And yes, I saw that film. I remember On the Beach. I saw that film titled On the Beach, Stephen, and I remember how chilled, how utterly chilled I could hardly, I mean, this was many years ago, I could hardly get up and turn the TV set off. It's like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. And since that film came out, the weapons that have been mass-produced are far, far more deadlier, far more destructive in terms of the nuclear genie. Than they were at that time. I also remember watching, remember the movie Failsafe? Oh, this couldn't happen. It couldn't happen. I watched it, and I had the same feeling after I watched the movie where it was like, oh, my God, are we insane? Has humanity lost its natural mind? My answer would be no, humanity has not, but its misleaders have. And you know, particularly in what is called the United States of America. We have got to make change now, systemically, now, if we are to survive as a human race on this precious, precious planet. And it's going to take sacrifices, and I love the fact that you pointed out, Stephen, that these are long struggles. Those of us who, you know, I've been in this struggle now for well over 45 years, and very little, and I expect that I will see very, very little of exactly what I wanted, okay, when I began over 45 years ago. However, that's part and parcel of what the struggle is. As you said, we pass the mantle on, all right? And this is, we have to take action right now. I feel chills even as I'm speaking. But again, I'm just so happy. I know I've said this repeatedly on this show, but my brother, I love you, and I'm so happy that you are back. Welcome back, my brother.
Oh, Larry, again, you're so kind. I must say I had a lot of moments when I wished I could host my program from what I called my cell during rehab. my cell without bars. I wish that I could do it, but you never know. It was impossible for me to do. For a good period of time, it physically was impossible. But when it became physically possible, I couldn't do it because you could get interrupted by somebody coming in, a nurse or somebody else to do this, to do that, to draw blood, to give you a pill, to do something or other. And I couldn't say, oh, hold on a minute, I'm on the air. So it was impossible to even think about something like that. And I remember once a number of years ago, I was hospitalized for a bloody nose that wouldn't stop bleeding. They cleared up in a couple of days, and I went home, and everything was fine. But when I got into my hospital room, it happened on a day that this program was on, and I'm sorry, it was a different program that I hosted. This was, I forget the year. It was about 6 or 7 years ago. I think just before I began hosting for PRN, it was on a different program, and I asked the nurse that got me into my room if I could host my program from my room, and she looked at me like I was nuts. Well, I got a backup host to take over for me, and he was very gracious enough to do it, even though at the time he was on vacation. He filled in for me anyway. But as I look back at that, I realize that it would have been impossible for me to host a decent program. I simply was not in shape to do it on that day. The very day I came in, I think the next day I felt a little bit better, and I might have been able to do it. And the third day when I got out of there and went home, I could have done it easily. But the day I came in would have been impossible. But that thought was always on my mind. It would have been a wonderful thing to be able to get on here and tell people what was going on with me and explain things and discuss the issues that I was unable to do, even though I couldn't write about them. I didn't have a computer. I didn't have any email addresses to communicate with anybody. There were just a few people who knew what was going on with me.
Well, I'm very glad that there were a precious few, at least, who knew, you know, because this was a great, great, great big concern on my part. And, you know, it's not just that I missed you politically, but I missed you spiritually. And I'm sure I'm speaking for, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of other people who felt and feel exactly the same way. So I want to thank you so much for what you are doing, what we must do. It's not a question of what we are doing, what we must do and are doing. I want to thank PRN as well.
Well, I thank you, Larry, and I thank PRN. I must say, we could only wish that we reach millions of people. Maybe one day the alternative media will reach millions, Larry. But wouldn't it be wonderful if we had the kind of audiences that popular television shows have? Not the news programs; they don't get the big audiences. People are turning away from them. But I don't know what the numbers sizes are in the most popular programs on television. But of course, television has the biggest reach, and it would be wonderful if we could reach audiences on that size and reach them on a regular basis. If we could be on a weekly or a nightly basis, telling people what they really needed to know and really be fostering world peace and benefiting people on a grand global scale, it would be wonderful. It makes me think about how much better would the world, how much longer could we survive, how much better would things be for the great majority of people if we could be practicing peace instead of waging war. It's amazing. I've read books by people like Seymour Melman, who's no longer with us, another man I wish I could have had on this program. He's been gone for a number of years. And his analysis, a professor at one of the New York universities, his analysis was, if we use the money that we spend on wars for civilian purposes to grow the country economically, I hate the phrase, but I'll use it anyway, we could get much more bang from the buck. We could get greater economic growth. We could put more people to work. We could make the nation more prosperous. But anybody who thinks that waging war is the way to create prosperity, they've got it backwards. The way to create prosperity is to put it to important civilian uses and get away from war making, and many, many people would benefit, including the war profiteers that benefit now. You can make a lot of money selling cars and trolleys and all kinds of consumer goods. You don't have to sell guns and tanks to make a buck. You can make it in lots of other ways.
Mm-hmm. You said it all. You said a mouthful, and you are absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. Wow. What can I say other than we better keep on, we better intensify and carry this struggle on, because at stake, and I just keep saying it, I know people might get tired of hearing me say it, but I'm going to keep on, at stake is our very survival as a species. our humanity and our planet. They have enough weapons now to knock this planet off of its axle. I mean, imagine that. They have enough nuclear and thermonuclear weapons to knock the Earth off of its axle.
Oh,
and
it's
that,
so true.
Of course,
it's so true, Larry. You know? He's gone now, but there was a famous biologist whose name escapes me at the moment who made the comment, I made it earlier, who made the comment that the way humanity is going, the human species may end up being the first species ever to destroy itself. And he said that species usually last about 100,000 years or so, and America was approaching the end of its lifespan. It's very possible that that human beings may be the first species to literally destroy itself.
Yeah. And I see that as a reality and as true. Therefore, we must be determined to do everything we can to make sure that that doesn't happen. But if it does, then we will have done everything we possibly could to have avoided it.
I certainly want to contribute my share, Larry, and you contribute your share. I feel that this is my time of life to give back, and nobody pays me a dime for doing anything that I do, and I really don't want to be paid for it. It's my joy and my passion to be writing, to be doing media work, to be being able to tell people what I think they need to know, and nobody can say you or I, Larry, are in the tank, because we're on nobody's payroll doing this kind of stuff. We do it because we think it's important to do, and really, when humanity is up for grabs, what could be more important? Important than that, trying to save this earth and trying to save humanity, so the people, the generations behind us, can enjoy some of the things that I think everybody needs to enjoy. This world can be a better place if enough people work for it, but it certainly won't happen by wishing for it.
That's right. You know, you remind me of the words of Albert Camus when he said that, and I'm paraphrasing, when he said something to the effect that it is the writer's responsibility to make sure that to save humanity from itself. That's what our responsibility is. We need, and I'm paraphrasing those words, but he was absolutely correct. You know, it's our responsibility to keep putting it out there. We need to save ourselves from ourselves, and we must do this. So I that's one of the reasons that, Stephen, you are one of the people that is an incredible inspiration to me, you know, and I just, you know, I keep praising you, but it's not just so much you that I'm talking about. I'm talking about the inspiration, and I'm sure that if you inspire me, and I've been involved in the movement for many decades, wow, you must be one heck of an inspiration to many, many others, and who knows? Quite frankly, we may begin to reach millions. Our job is to do that everywhere. We can begin right here in this nation. I know you're heard, and so am I to some extent all over the world. But we've got to be heard right here in this nation to actualize people, get people to take action, because their very lives, our very lives, are at stake.
Absolutely, Larry. I must say very honestly that you and other wonderful guests like you are my inspiration to do what I do. We reinforce each other, Larry, and we provide the inspiration for us to do more and more and more, because we understand the stakes. We try to explain it to people, and we hope that other people will grasp it and spread the word to still more people. And when enough people decide that it's up to us to change things, then maybe we really can have constructive change for the better. Oh, I absolutely believe it can happen. Maybe I wouldn't be doing this stuff if I felt otherwise.
Well, same here. I mean, people do say, well, you know, after what you've been through and how they set you up and have tried to set you up and in prison and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do you really think it's worth it? My response is, if it wasn't worth it, I wouldn't be doing it. Of course it's worth it. You know, that's my passion. That just says it's your passion. Of course it's worth it.
What could be worth more than survival, Larry? I wish we had more time. The air time has run out. It's been a wonderful program, Larry. I look forward to having you back. I'm still catching up a little bit, but I'll get back to you and get you back on the program again to keep discussing the major issues that everybody needs to know about and then pass the word to others. Many, many thanks, Larry.
Thank you. Love you, Stephen. You take care and stay strong.
Thank you, Larry.